Hi, hello. On today's episode of the Dunker Spot, we talk about the Spurs and the Knicks. Game 5 coming up soon. Who's the finals MVP? As the emotion wears off, who's going to get it done going forward? We also have a deep dive on WNBA All-Stars. Who's going to make it? Back and forth we go. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Let's talk basketball.
Let's talk some basketball indeed, Steve. The rare two-day break between finals games, so we had some time to dig in, go back through game four a little bit while also spinning it forward as we have a pivotal game 5 coming up this weekend. We'll see if that series ends or if it extends. But, Steve, we did our best, and I think we did a darn good job, of talking through whatever the heck that game 4 was, where the San Antonio Spurs set this tone defensively. They drive all over the place. They have pick and roll counters. They make three after three after three, insert 11 more of those to get to the 14 that they made in the first half. And then the Knicks found their rhythm. Jalen Brunson kept cooking. OG Anunoby kept making big plays. A 29-point lead was ultimately erased, and the Knicks have a 3-1 series lead. Our live stream, as we mixed in important X's and O's conversation into concepts that mattered, but a lot of it was, holy crap, this is awesome. Basketball is awesome. What an initial effort from the Spurs. What a comeback from the Knicks. Now that we've had some time to step away from the emotion of what that game was, is there anything that stood out more to you or that popped for you on a second watch through? Anything that you hit on a little bit during the live stream that you want to hammer home a little bit more now? Like, how has the game kind of settled in the belly for you now?
I'll get to the game was the game. And the Knicks took the game. The Spurs offered them the opportunity to take the game. A lot of times a comeback comes down to a perfect storm of equal events where one team does not meet the moment and the other team does. Mm-hmm. I think to me, I made a conscious decision yesterday to sit back and just see what y'all talking about. What y'all about to say?
Okay.
So once we just kind of peel the onion, let's peel away the choke. Let's peel away the bad coaching. Let's peel away the fire Mitch Johnson. Let's peel away the De'Aaron Fox. Let's peel away the Wimby can't play 44 minutes. Let's peel away the Keldon Johnson. Let's peel away all of that stuff. Okay. What do we truly have in this one? Do we have a perfect storm, or do we have a series that's unbalanced? What is the true meaning of this? And I think this is where the odd dynamic of the series goes. And this is where, because it's an elimination game, I don't know necessarily how to process it. Because, again, no one is talking about all the good things the Spurs did in the first half to put the Knicks in that position. That's just been washed out the window. That's how basketball works. That's how history works. It is what it is. You lose, you blow that lead, we don't really care what you did. I don't know why it does that, but it is what it is. It was funny to like absorb all of the narratives that came out after that game and then watch the first possession of the third quarter. And it's just, well, yeah, we're putting Wimby in action. And the Spurs were like, cool. Wimby's at the level. Pre-rotate to Cat's pop. Rotate around it. Nothing for you. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not the picture that's really been painted to a degree, but does it matter? Because the Knicks won. I don't know. I think what I really leaned into watching that third quarterback, it's not the Spurs took so many threes. Oh, that's the other part of that first possession. De'Aaron Fox rejected a screen, forced defense to help, kicked the Devin Vassell for a wide open three, just missed. Like, that's not in that compilation that's floating around. But I think for me, it's more so the Spurs have been good in this series. The Spurs have led in every game in this series. How much weight does that carry with the fact that they can no longer lose? And how much weight does that carry with the fact that can you actually shake the New York Knicks? Like, they put them in tough spots. They've put pressure on them. They defended the heck out of them. But have they broken them is my question. And so I don't necessarily think that all of a sudden this series flips because Jalen Brunson put Wembanyama in action and got buckets. He had quite literally no other choice. He had no other choice. And it was the ripple effect. It was the ripple effect of him being able to get those buckets, and also the fact that Wemby was now in a different type of rotation and the Spurs couldn't necessarily get him back to where he wanted to, and the Knicks played out of it. The Spurs also got themselves back into the same trap of playing too fast in certain moments, and then they got themselves in a different trap of playing too slow without intention. So they did two different things. Because if you go back to the start of that third quarter, Spurs getting stops. Why are you going bang, bang, bang? Like, your aggression got you what you the lead. But at a certain point, you got to be like, okay, we don't have it. Pull it out, screen, do something, get to the next part. They're just like, nope, yeet. And it's like, I get it. That has brought you to the dance. But have a little bit of a dial back in you to where now, okay, let's get them back to having to defend and hit their pressure points. And so I think overall, it's hard to truly absorb it because I think the Spurs did a lot of good things. I think the Knicks countered with a lot of good things in that second half, obviously. What does it mean? It means the Knicks only need one more win. So for me, it's like, How much of the third and fourth quarter was the Spurs landing on the wrong coverages and mixing the wrong things in? Because we've seen them go drop to late switch. We've seen them go outright switch. We've seen them go two on the ball pre-rotate. We've seen them offensively do different things. They didn't have the strongest Wemby in the third quarter, and he got more tired as it went on. If he had had more juice, would he have been able to be the half court? Like, I don't know that portion. And so, yeah, I'm supposed to be the person that tells you exactly what's happening. I don't know. Because the New York Knicks refuse to stop. Like they refuse to be a different team. This is who they are. This is what they've been. Not only this playoff run, this entire season. And so the Spurs are going to have to take this from them three times. And in my brain, that sounds difficult. But I also recognize the Spurs have literally, quite literally, been winning in every single game we've seen in these finals. And it hasn't mattered. Where are you at? Like, I know I'm going right now, but I'm just trying to like process it in my brain.
No. I think you are fine. I think a couple of things in particular that you said there are things that I had in my notes and wanted to bounce off of. One, you touched on it early. I think the overall effort the Spurs put in to put the Knicks down 29 is kind of being slept on because the comeback happened. So naturally that takes precedence. The winners get the right history, all of that good stuff. Tied to that, something else that you hit on, is that the shot quality that the Spurs were generating, at least early on in the third quarter, was a lot higher than people are probably going to give it credit for because the threes in particular did not go down. And I think your point about the tempo and how quickly they were going at points in that third quarter was a strong point that I honestly meant to hit on during the live stream, but because of everything that happened in the game, just didn't get to it. But one of the things I wanted to note, and I had a number with it, was the Spurs, 75 offensive rating in transition in game four. They were much worse in like an offensive rating of roughly 106 offensive rating in the half court in that game for the Spurs, a 75 in transition. If you're going to have those two numbers, it's normally going to be flipped. We got out in transition, ran after misses, turnovers, whatever. We just couldn't do anything against a set defense. Very rarely do you see it flipped, and very rarely do you see it flipped to that drastic of a degree. To that point about going yeet in transition, this is precisely how Stephon Castle picked up the fourth foul very early on in that third quarter. Off of a miss, outlet to him. Let me see if I can beat you with a move to the rim. He got timed right. Runs through somebody and is going the other way. And it's like, well, that seems less than ideal. And it circles back to, you know, a question I posed to you during, you know, the live after game four was like, how much of the Brunson portion and some of the late defense on him was because Stephon Castle couldn't defend with his usual physicality in light of the foul trouble that he had. And so it was interesting to also watch that second halfback and be like, oh, well, this feels a little bit better than what it felt like in real time, but the shots didn't go down, or you turned the ball over. And the Knicks once again just kind of get the flow out of that. And to the criticism about like the Wimby minutes, like on its surface, I do think it's fair. Like 44 minutes, he has played in 40 plus minutes. He's logged 40 plus minutes in 3 of his last 5 games. I don't think he logged the 40 minute game during the regular season. And so like this is just different for him. And you can kind of feel some of the fatigue later on as the Knicks kept putting him in action. I think to shoot Mitch Johnson some bail that nobody really wants to hear, when was he supposed to sneak in the Wimby rest so he could be fresh? Because it was like 8 minutes left where the Knicks made the run and chipped it to 22, put it in my notes. I said, oh, the Knicks have chipped this thing down to 22. The Spurs need to get back on track. You don't want this to be like 14 heading into the fourth quarter, is what I typed in my notes at the time. And so like the lead is dwindling. And so normally you want to sneak in the mid-quarter break for Wimby. So then he can close the quarter and then he starts on the bench in the fourth. And then you kind of go from there. The Knicks just kept happening. Jalen Brunson kept happening. To your point, Steve, the Spurs, we're playing a little fast now. Okay, it's time to settle down. Wow, it's 4 on the clock now. They couldn't find that balance. So then for that point, like as you said pretty consistently throughout the series, the Luke Kornet minutes have not been great for San Antonio in this series, and we only got 4 of them in this game. So it's just like, okay, when do you want to do this? Because on one hand, throughout the postseason, it's been criticism of, hey, Wimby, you just kind of have to suck it up. The Kornet minutes aren't working. You got to play more. He does that. The Knicks put him in action. And because the Knicks are making this comeback, you couldn't really afford to sneak a break in for him. Now it's, why did he play that many consecutive minutes? No wonder he took a bunch of jumpers, et cetera. Like, the criticism is fair because it happened, but, like, the context of it is kind of being lost. And watching that game back, yeah, like, I still maintain I would have liked Wimby to drive a little bit more than he did in the third quarter based on the success that he had in the first half. But I also kind of understand why it didn't break that way in light of things that the Knicks did defensively, toggling some matchups, altering when they wanted to send help. Like, the Knicks' defense, I think, is kind of getting slept in what happened with the comeback because of how incredible the shot-making was on the other end. And, you know, just to circle back to your overall point, Steve, and I'll toss it back to you, it did just kind of become a perfect storm of the Spurs not really having answers to the test but putting them in the wrong spots. And the Knicks just countering what they did and then dictating terms on top of that. And that's how we end up here.
It's very funny to think back to Stephon Castle goes to the sideline, De'Aaron Fox hits step-back jumper over OG Anunoby, and that will be lost to the annals of history forever. that just won't exist. I mean, I think in the scenario, right, it's not about not criticizing Mitch Johnson, but if you're doing the whole, he can't coach, he gotta go, he got this team to the finals, and he overcame
the finals.
Like, you take a, like, take a deep breath, take a break, drink some water, figure it out. But I think for me, this is always the balance when it comes to your starting lineup, your starting players, your best players. When you go for the gusto, when you swing for the fences, you put yourself in a position where we may not have enough in the tank at the end of this run. And so if you're thinking, hey, we're up in this game, we're going back and forth, Wimby stays out there, we give him a 58-second break to a degree of game time, and then we go back to just finish this thing and hopefully get him some more rest on the back end, that just didn't happen. You never got the back end of that idea because the Knicks never stopped playing. And so that's the risk. You could have put Luke Kornet out there for 4 minutes, and maybe that sparks the run. Maybe you get the same result. There's no telling. We can't retell history. But you went for it. And sometimes when you go for it in coaching, you miss. You know what the consequence could be. You're hoping it doesn't happen. And then it's at your door and you got to try and figure it out. That's the thing you got to remember. Like, as a coach, you are trying to control a game that is not controllable. It's the biggest thing I learned. You are putting all this work in to have all these answers and think about all of these potential scenarios that may or may not happen. And no matter what you have said, done, prepped for, it does not mean that you know exactly what's going to happen in that moment. You can't control it. Mm-hmm. That's why I learned how to let go of control. You just do the work and do your best. Your best didn't get it done. So now how do you respond to that? I think if you're the Spurs, it's one game at a time, right? Mm-hmm. And so I framed this a lot in the fact that this is an elimination game and the Knicks could just put together 48 and get it done. If I'm San Antonio, I need to do everything I can on Saturday to get this game back to New York. And then we got to do everything we can to get this game back to San Antonio. We saw them be down 3-2 against the Thunder. Right?
Yeah.
Now, 3-1 is different than 3-2. But the scenario remains a little bit similar. We need to win mm-hmm. one game at home, and then we need to win one game on the road.
Mm-hmm.
All the they just have to get it to 7. That's all. That's all their mm-hmm. minds have to go to. And it's interesting because I go back to the Wembanyama quote, their inexperience may be their advantage. Well, you've got an experience where your inexperience was your disadvantage. How do you respond to that? Mm. And no matter what we've seen in this series, the Spurs have jumped out in every single game. So what are they going to bring to the table in this game 5? And are they going to be able to keep the Knicks down? That's the part in the back of my brain where I'm just stuck, because that first half from the Spurs was quite literally their most impressive performance of the postseason. Quite literally. Everything you would have wanted them to do in that scenario, they did. They had the garden not shaking. So I credit the Knicks for taking all that off the board, right? But mm-hmm. at the same time, if I'm the Spurs, you have to continue to just pull on that rope. Can't let go of the rope. You got to keep pulling on the rope. If I'm the Knicks, and this is why, you know, a lot of time we talk about the quotes with the Knicks, this is why they're talking the way they're talking. They understand how good this team is. They know how good they are. And the credit for the Knicks is none of this has absolutely taken them out of what they want to do offensively or defensively, right? It's one of the things I mm-hmm. want to talk about. Like, no matter what the Spurs are presenting, no matter how good the Spurs have played, have the Knicks truly ever gotten away from what they want to do? Like, think about that first half, right? We mm-hmm. cannot go off-ball movement. We cannot get Karl-Anthony Towns going. Jalen Brunson pick and roll not working. We are having a tough time defensively. They kept playing. This is just who they are.
mm-hmm.
They lean on their identity. They believe in their identity. They believe in each other, and they just keep going on both ends of the floor. So we have just a battle of wills to a degree that has played out in spectacular mm-hmm. form, basketball-wise.
No, I it's right there with you. Like, this is why the Knicks are able to make the comeback that they do. This is why, off of heartbreak, the Spurs were able to come back and win the game 3 the way that they did. Like, these are two teams that are very well aware of what we can do. And based on what we've faced throughout different portions of the year, our down moments don't shake us to this degree. Now, to your point, this is a closeout game of the NBA Finals. And so all of that sounds great, but this is just a very different context that you're having to deal with. It helps that the Spurs are going to be at home while trying to navigate this portion, hopefully get an extra boost from their perspective. But this is going to be a fascinating one. And what I've been kind of stewing on, kind of as like a base thought, is that obviously based on what we saw in the second half of that game, there is cleaning up to do offensively for the San Antonio Spurs with their process. There's cleaning up to do defensively with their process for San Antonio Spurs. I've been trying to navigate, like, what is most important for them to clean up as we enter the game 5? Because as you mentioned, they have jumped out to early leads in pretty much every game of this series. So it's not like they can't have good starts. It's more so been the sustaining of it and the Knicks coming up big in clutch moments. And so for me, it's like, is it more important for them to be super process peel, generate good stuff offensively so they can set that defense and put the Knicks in the box that they were in for, especially the first quarter, but largely the first half? Or is it more important for them to establish the defense early so they can run, ideally have way more success in transition than they did in game 4, and then the loop starts that way. Like, both are important, but I've been kind of stuck on what is most important for them to establish based on what the second half was.
The offense. It has to be the offense.
The offense for you.
The Spurs defense hasn't gone away. Like, comeback or not, but the Spurs defense has been the Spurs defense. The Knicks got them in that second half. And I think they'll adjust to that because it's not something we haven't seen before. Even if we talk about that game 3 win from San Antonio, the Knicks got them in the second quarter and the Spurs were able to respond defensively. Like, you're not, they can trust, they, or they should be able to trust that defense will be there. They have to get the offense to a certain level to where they feel they can have a confidence to sustain in the half court, to have something that pokes at the Knicks, to just have that mindset to force them to guard and get the kind of shots they want. I think that's the most important thing. If they can do that, they'll be fine. I think the defense, ultimately, no matter how many times you got Victor Wembanyama, if you're sitting there saying Jalen Brunson putting Wimby in action is going to be the answer, I'm so sorry, because the Spurs are going to shape shift anyways. So, yeah, you might get back to it. You have to work to get back to it. And think about how many times, like, the contrast of game 3 and game 4, the Knicks still were having to, like, get multiple people running up towards Jalen Brunson to make sure Wimby was out of the corner and in the action. So it's like, it's not an automatic. That's the thing about the Spurs defense. They don't give you automatics often. And you might find one, but as soon as you find one, they're going to figure it out and process it and make it a little bit harder for you to get to. So for me, it's having a mindset offensively, carry over what you did in the first half, be intentional, put Brunson in action, put Cat in action, play out of that, and then allow your defense to be set. The more you're able to score, the better off you are. You shot sub 30 in the second half. That's a large portion of why you lost, because you never really were able to get set. You didn't really put any pressure on them. You didn't get the bucks you wanted. The funniest part is it was like stuck on 81-59 for like 4 minutes in that third quarter. What felt like. So, yeah, if you get some more buckets, that'll take you out of prevent. That'll get the Knicks out of being able to flow off your misses, and you'll be in a good position. But if I'm New York, I don't care about any of that. I just need to win this game. That's all I got to do.
Landry Shamet, what you got for me? Just knock down some shots for me, big dog. But no, you go with the offense. I'm probably inclined to agree with that, honestly, just because within the broader context of the conversations we've been having about the San Antonio Spurs, we both kind of landed on what exactly is the thing that you can go back to consistently. And with the Knicks working as hard as they have all series long to take away the Wimby roles in particular, which it's fun to judge from game 2 to game 3, felt like, okay, fine, finally, spun some things that they can poke at with this Knicks group. And early on in the game 4, it's like, oh, they are countering the high tags. This seems good. They still couldn't get to it super consistently in the second half. Like, they still haven't been able to fully, they've unlocked Wimby in spots in this series. They have not done the thing or done multiple things to a level where, okay, Wimby is just now firmly on the table as a roller. And without that, there is a lot of pressure on the guards to make plays. Go to the end of game 3 in those spots. When De'Aaron Fox has it rolling, it feels good. You talk about game 4, or 90% of the minutes that Dylan Harper played in game 4, he had it going. You feel pretty good about it. Stephon Castle, when he's had it going back to like the first half of game 3, you feel good about it. But that is a lot of pressure on them against a Knicks defense that can shapeshift in their own right and toggle matchups. And in general, they just have a bunch of good perimeter defenders they can toss out. To where, like, yeah, we could kind of box you in with some stuff too. Like, if we're mixing in these high tags, we're eliminating the role, we are limiting your decision-making tree overall. And depending on who the ball handler is, we might can show some strong side help and get away with it sometimes. I haven't loved that all the time in this series when the Knicks have kind of gone to it with those swipes from the strong side. But, like, there is a level of comfort, at the very least, they seem to feel in doing that. They'll mix in some unders because we don't care if you take pull-up shots. Like, if it's not transition, there is just a general, what can the guards get to consistently to make the Knicks bend? I think to your earlier comment, Steve, that's part of why the Knicks haven't felt like we have to completely shift what we do defensively. Why you haven't been able to fully move them. Because you have had stretches and you've had pockets of where we can dictate terms offensively, but not to a scheme busting degree. It has largely been we are winning our matchups in some capacity. Like you mentioned, the De'Aaron Fox step back over OG Anunoby in that third quarter. That's going to be lost in history. De'Aaron, even with the fourth quarter, like, did he make enough shots to where the Knicks felt like, okay, we got to put two on the ball against De'Aaron? We haven't had that in the game.
I don't know if it's about putting two on the ball, though. I think I would disagree in the sense that I don't think they have to do that. They just have to get to Cat and Brunson. They just have to engage the big and pick and roll. If they do that, they did their job. So are they going to get an easy lane to the basket? No. But in theory, if I get someone to engage on this drop and I get the weak side to hold for two more seconds, that now becomes an advantage for us, and we had to play out of that. So I don't necessarily think that they haven't poked at it. The whole turnaround of game three in the first half of game four was the Spurs guards doing that over and over and over again, and the Knicks not being able to contain. So that would be my counter, but continue.
So I was just saying, like, to that point, like, game three is the best that we've seen on that front. But even then, like, did that change how the Knicks wanted to guard in game four? When they were hitting all those threes in game four, did we see, like, a wholesale shift of what the Knicks were doing? Or, to your point, did they just keep playing, trusting what they do? They execute it better, and we kind of flow from there. Not that the Knicks didn't make literally any adjustment, but I don't think there has been, like, a series shifting way from the Spurs offensively yet. And that's where I'm just like, what can they do to make that the case, if it's even possible, versus we won because we won the matchups?
I mean, that's more so this is the battle. These are two teams with firm identities. It's not about being good in this one. It's about being able to do it over and over again. You're not going to break the Knicks and turn them into, well, Cat has to trap this pick and roll, and we're not going to. No, they're going to play how they want to play. The Spurs are going to do the same thing on their end. We're going to shape-shift defensively. You got to beat us. That's the story of this finals. It's the question I wanted to ask you. Is it about being good or great, or is it about being good or great over and over and over and over again? Because I think that's what it comes down to. The Spurs have done a lot of good things. They have had moments in almost every game where they stop doing good things. The Knicks have done stuff over and over and over and over again. Is that a discredit to the Spurs, or is that a credit to the Knicks, Nikias?
I feel like, to that last question, I think that's more of a credit to the Knicks, especially in light of how good the Spurs are generally. To be able to have the second half, we'll go back to game four, to have that second half against that Spurs defense and to put Wimby in action to that degree and to have enough counters and to have that kind of force and consistency behind it. Because it goes from, let's just go high pick and roll with Cat, let's see if we can get Wimby. And the Spurs being like, well, actually, no, we're going to keep you low. And then it's Jose Alvarado like, no, well, fine, I'll just be the second screener to make sure that you're up here and do that. Like, that portion stood out to me. And the Knicks being able to execute to that degree, I think they deserve a lot of credit for that, hence the actual win. And so, like, I don't think it's not easy to do that to a great team. And this is a conversation we've had more broadly before. You know, take the series away, where when you see a team or a player perform this well, I'm more inclined to go, wow, you must have done really good things, or you must have been really prepared to do this versus slandering the other side. Like, I am just pro, holy crap, you did a cool thing. It's generally how I want to approach it. So, like, to answer your question, like, I'm more so impressed with the Knicks having that resolve and ultimately getting it done. To the other question, is it about, like, being firmly good or being able to find the answers when you need them? We're late enough in the series now where it is just more of the latter at this point. For the Spurs, ideally, you not only win game five, but you win it in a way that you present a new problem to the Knicks. I don't know if that is going to happen. I'm curious, and I guess I'll kind of flip that question to you. Is there an area of the game, or is there a pet action? Like, within attacking Cat and Brunson, is there a way to do that in a particular way that would pose a different problem to the Knicks? Is that anything you foresee?
I mean, if I could foresee things, I would go and get a lottery ticket right now. Well, I'd be out of here.
Yes.
That's what I would do. But One of the subtle moments of that game four was the amount of times the Spurs wanted to put Brunson and Cat in action together. They didn't get a lot out of it, but they had the mindset to do it. Got away from it, but that was in the back of my brain. I think it's just about, can you get to Cat in pick and roll? Can you make him engage? Can you get Jalen Brunson to do anything other than a quick show and recover? That just has to be something they have foundationally. Can you get to Mitchell Robinson when he's in? Can you force the Knicks to hold their help more and now get quicker and easier driving lanes for your team? So now we got rolls. We got shots if we want them. We can kick and spray and beat your closeouts. That's the overall philosophy for me. I think if you are the Knicks, though, overall, you got to look at what we've done so far to get here. And like Jalen Brunson in pick and roll versus Victor Wembanyama. Do I think that's a series shifter? No. Can it be a series ender? Yes. Stick with me. I don't know if you can just spam Wemby in action the entire game. Eventually, he's going to adjust. It was interesting to watch in that second half. He kind of leaned on drop, but Jalen Brunson was so shifty, the guards and wings couldn't necessarily navigate and get back into a position where he wasn't getting back to his spot. So now, okay, we go switch. Now we go switch and double. Jalen Brunson gets Wemby on a few switches, whether it's a shot or a drive, and that opens things up. Are they going to land on something that takes that off the board? And how much of an impact is that going to be? Because I think ultimately, no matter what we talk about, fourth quarter, you know where the Knicks' bread is butter. And are you going to be able to stop him in those moments? You can make him go 8 for 28 in the first three quarters if you want. If he goes 4 for 6 in the fourth, what did you do? What did you accomplish? What did you get done? That's where it becomes tough. And that's the greatness of a player like Jalen Brunson. That's the tough part of winning a series like this. Nekias Duncan, mm-hmm. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Most points per game in the fourth quarter of an NBA Finals since 1996-97. Do you know who has the most? Highest average?
Would that be Jalen Brunson?
It sure the hell would. 10.3 so far in this series. 10.3 points a game in the fourth quarter of the NBA Finals. Allen Iverson had 10. Salute to Allen Iverson and what he did for the Sixers in that series. Michael Jordan, 9.8. Giannis, 9.3. So all of you can sit there and say, oh, Giannobi is scoring this many points, taking this many less shots. He doesn't have to do the same thing that guy has to do. How are we losing these recipes, Nekias? This guy's asked to create magic out of nothing. Just go do stuff. And he does it. And we're sitting here talking about, this is the greatest true shooting percentage in NBA Finals history.
I don't care!
I don't care! 1.73 points per... I don't care!
Wow. I did not know this is where we were transitioning. But we can't have the finals MVP conversation.
Yeah. Who's the finals MVP, Nekias? Put it on the board.
Put it on the board is insane. Well, I guess I do not have to ask you who your finals MVP would be if the series ends in 5. Obviously, the game 5 has to be played. But for me, I have kind of been torn cycling through the cases of Karl Anthony Towns, who I literally said and tweeted through the first two games, like he's just in the lead right now. And the game 3 was not kind to him. Game 4, very timely, but at the very least didn't have like the high box score stuff. Still funny, as I mentioned during the end of the stream, he led the game in plus minus, which was a funny one. Ended up with a double-double anyway. So like the Cat case, he has defended Wemby well. He has been very important to the Knicks offensively, both as a driver, his knockdown shots, as a hub, though, as you mentioned, the Spurs have done a lot of work to try to take the hub work away from the Knicks offense as a whole. But, like, he's been very important, very impactful of offense. Think leading the series in plus minus if you care about that kind of thing. Jalen Brunson, for all the reasons that you listed, his offensive burden is higher than anyone else's in this series, for that matter. He has the highest offensive burden in the series. Who he has to create against, he has seen a good bit of Stephon Castle. He's seen some Devin Vassell. He's seen some Carter Bryant. And then you have to deal with Wimby lurking on top of all of that. And he just has to get bucket after bucket after bucket for this group. The efficiency has not been great. I think through four games, the Knicks have still technically like lost his minutes on the series overall. That is a ding to the case. But you mentioned the fourth quarter. You get to that point, and he has been better than anyone. And he has consistently come through in these fourth quarters. And I think generally speaking, I guess this goes back to a conversation we kind of had about when the Celtics won their title. And I think Jaylen Brown ends up getting that finals MVP over Jason Tatum, where I'm just kind of like, the guy that sets the table, you have to like thoroughly outplay that guy to not get that award. Because even if they don't score as efficiently, defenses are geared to them in a way that they aren't geared to whoever the second option is, third option is, et cetera. So like to your point, OG Anunoby has not faced the same level of defensive attention as Jalen Brunson. And so to argue him, or Cat for that matter, though Cat gets defensive tilt to him as the number two there. In order for either of those guys to kind of dethrone Brunson in this conversation, they have to thoroughly outplay Jalen Brunson. And that's where I think the game five is going to be interesting. Because if Jalen Brunson follows up this 36-point performance, insanity in the second half, with a big scoring night that was efficient in the Knicks win, et cetera, I think it's just going to tilt to him by default. Just because of all the attention that he has to soak in to make life a little bit easier for everyone else. And if he responds anyway, then you have that. I'd say to the OG piece, like even beyond like points plus the true shooting or whatever, I think not only has he scored, like the timeliness of his baskets throughout this series have been pretty important. Like obviously he just capped this game four with the tip in, but even in that first half where the Knicks were very much trying to figure out where are we getting offense from, he had very important late shot mates to have. First quarter and the second quarter in particular, but had late shots made, some late drives to get to the free throw line, some random self-created shots inside the arc just to kind of help keep them afloat. So it's not just like OG is standing in the corner the entire series and he's just feasting on wide open catch shoot looks. Like there has been a level of self-creation and timely shot creation within this series for him really throughout the whole thing, not even just the game four, but wanting to go to the game four since that's the last thing that we saw. Yeah, like I think he's been important with when he's had to make some of these.
Right. Let's go back to that same second quarter in that game four. The same second quarter where Jalen Brunson had 15 points.
Yes.
It had to carry things afloat. Like, this is where I'm saying. This is not a discredit to OG. He has been very timely. He's been very good. He's been very good defensively. He's been a rock for the Knicks. He's not the foundation of what they're doing. Jalen Brunson is having to bring the ball up against full court pressure, the table. Mm-hmm. And by set the table, I mean pick and roll for me. Let me get a matchup. Maybe it's two on the ball. I need to do something to make Victor Wembanyama react. Now here's a kick for y'all. Or I can go ahead and get to my spot, make a basket. Or, hey, game's on the line. Super, super tall person in front of you. Step back three. Yep, got it. Like, that should not be lost in history because of a spreadsheet, because of efficiency, because of plus minus. Being asked to do a lot at your job is often not quantifiable. He's the one who has to get in the paint and try and figure out, how do I get this ball back out to the perimeter? Where's that go on the spreadsheet, guys? Which points per possession stat is that? He's the one who has to get the coverage and get the defensive attention. Where does that go? Who's quantifying that?
Before I respond, is this rhetorical or how are we going about
this? I'm asking you.
Okay. I guess in a very literal sense, like, let's see. Okay, who's leading the team in touches? That's largely going to be Jalen Brunson. what level of defensive attention is he getting? Like, what coverages are you seeing? How often is he seeing help defenders on his drives? Like, you can like kind of build a case on what that is. Like, I don't disagree. I've even said Jalen Brunson has the highest offensive burden, not just for the Knicks, but in this series overall. I think that is very fair. No one is asked to do what he is asked to do. The pushback that I would have is, like, I don't think the OG case is just built on spreadsheet looks nice, let's give it to him. Because while he does not have the offensive, I think it is built on, again, the timely shot making. Threes have been important. The drives have been important. Obviously, the offensive rebounding when he sprinkles it in has been important, hence the end of game four. The defense has been incredibly important. OG Anunoby, throughout the series, being able to cycle through the De'Aaron Fox matchup, sprinkle in some matchups on Devin Vassell as well, some Stephon Castle, has had to guard Wimby, especially when everyone got in foul trouble, they had to slide to the five. And at different moments when the Knicks have gone small, OG has had to take on the Wimby assignment as well. I think there is like a legitimate two-way impact piece to this for OG Anunoby. Now, it helps that he is having like one of, if not the most efficient 20-point per game, whatever the overall stat is, the most efficient 20-point per game final series in NBA history. Like, that is also a feather in the cap, to be clear. And I think that is a fair thing to bring up. For me, when he's doing this is important. How efficiently he's doing this is also important. What he's being tasked to do on the defensive end is also important. And so, like, I do think it is fair to acknowledge, like, I do think OG Anunoby has a case. To your point, I also think Jalen Brunson has a case. If Cat has a big game five, that would be, at least in my opinion, three games out of the five in which Cat has been the best or most impactful guy for the New York Knicks, in my opinion. I may be in the minority in that. But I'm just saying, if we get the game, if he has a big game five and the Knicks win, that would be three out of five for Cat, in my opinion. And so, like, he would also have a case.
How many points does Crawley score in the fourth quarter in this series?
He had, what, his first fourth quarter bucket in the game four, correct? Either in the game three or the game four. And then, as you alluded to in the live, you know, in the live stream in game four, like, the timeliness of the step back three plus the drive was pretty big in that fourth quarter as he finally got to play, dealing with foul trouble earlier on in the game. So I guess I will say slash pose to you, Steve, because again, we do not disagree that one, Jalen Brunson's offensive role is up here and the level of responsibility is up here. Two, the fourth quarter scoring and decision-making in particular has been very important. And he is scoring at an incredibly high rate in these fourth quarters. You do kind of have to get to that point to where the fourth quarter matters. How are
they getting to that point? What's a part of it?
It's Brunson. It's Cat. It's also OG. Like, I think for me, I think our disconnect is, while we both recognize Brunson is asked to do the most, in terms of the actual productivity within that, I don't think there is as large of a gap, at least through the first three quarters, between Brunson, Cat, and OG Anunoby. I think that's the disconnect and overall, like, primary disagreement point. Because the fourth quarter, it just has been Brunson.
No, there's no disconnect. There's not a respect for the role that Jalen Brunson has to play.
You say
Brunson doesn't do what he does without those two. Those two don't do what they do without him. It's all symbiotic, like, it's all works together. But it's easier to look at the impact of the other two than what Jalen Brunson does. And that's fine.
I feel like I've given the appropriate amount of respect to what Jalen Brunson does. Like, that is a whole lot of attention that he has to deal with and ultimately draws. I'm just saying those other two, like Cat in particular, draws his own level of defensive attention. And OG Anunoby, with the way that he has capitalized on that, the level of self-creation he has also had to sprinkle in on top of the playing off of Brunson and Cat, et cetera. And then there's the defense.
It's so funny you say the level of self-creation when that's all Jalen Brunson has had to do.
Yes, I'm not arguing that he is like self-created on the level of Brunson. I'm more so highlighting that it hasn't just been OG is feasting off of Cat plus Brunson attention. Because if it was just that, the scoring and the scoring efficiency wouldn't be as loud for people, I would say. It is the fact that it has legit been a mix for OG. Like, that's all I'm trying to highlight. Again, the Brunson scoring low and scoring shots are more difficult. I'm not arguing. Like, we are in alignment there. I'm just saying the OG thing isn't just he's feasting on easy stuff, and this is how he got there.
Who's saying that, though? he just asked to take less shots. That's all. No one thinks it's easy. He's made a lot of tough baskets, but he's not having the engine. He's not having to power this. You came home at bedtime. All you had to do was put the pajamas on.
We could get into a bunch of like house related comps here. We will leave that be. But okay, Jalen Brunson would be your selection right now. I think that is firm. I think heading into game five, I would probably give OG a slight lead heading into the game five with the two-way impact that he's had in the series. But we will see how five plays out. Before we take our break, is there anything else that's like in the back of the brain for you heading into this game five that intrigues you? Scheme thing, no. Player thing, rotation thing, anything of the sort? Okay.
No.
Well, then in that case, I have
what happened.
Okay. Well, in that case, I have a literal
empty your notes, bud.
Not even a note emptying. The one question I posed, I think you hinted to it a little bit in the game four live stream, to where it's related to Wemby playing the minutes. We only saw 4 minutes of Luke Kornet, et cetera. We didn't see Harrison Barnes. Do you think we're going to see Harrison Barnes, or just in general more bench minutes from San Antonio in game five?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they go small at some point, but I would imagine it won't be Wemby doing that again. Now, the flip side of that is in the OKC series, when everyone said, boy, Wemby was so tired, he played a whole lot of minutes and he did a whole lot of good things. So you never know, but I wouldn't be surprised if the attempt is a little bit different, whether it's Carter Bryant the five or Harrison Barnes the five or something like that. They're going to have to do something to get Wemby a blow at some point so that he can be impactful as opposed to being on the court. Because if he's going to be out there and he's spaced, you're hoping the guards create and they're able to attack him and pick and roll and also make him close out multiple times. Like, that's not the greatest Victor Wembanyama. It's like asking me to do a podcast at 11:30 at night. Like, are you getting the most out of me? Probably not. I'm a try hard though. Like, you know, it's just, can they maximize his impact? I think is going to be the biggest goal for San Antonio.
Okay. I thought you did a great job with the late night pods. I'll give you the
salute. I was tired.
Hey, listen. And you cooked anyway. We are going to keep cooking, but first we're going to take a quick break. When we return, we are shifting to the W side as All-Star voting is live. And, buddy, I am excited and annoyed. We're going to get into that after the break. Please stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift to the WNBA side, Steve. Again, we are deep into Commissioner's Cup play that ends next Wednesday. All-Star voting is officially live, Steve. And All-Star voting live now through June the 27th. So you have a couple of weeks to parse through some things to vote for All-Star starters, which is going to be a mix of the fan vote, media, et cetera. 4 guards total. 6 front court players total. And so the conversation we want to have is not who deserves to be an all-star, because that is a longer list. And we're still going to go through different names, of course. But this is about who should be among the 10. Who should be the 4 guards? Who should be the 6 front court players? And Steve, I apologize in advance. I would like to start with a very quick rant on this.
Is this the same rant you do every year?
It's one of them.
Okay.
That's one of them for sure. This isn't the, hey, decide how important it is, et cetera. I will save that one for when we get the false voting returns. And then I have ample opportunity to yell about that if I see fit. The one I want to get into today, Steve, is as this is split up into the backcourt and the front court, in order to be able to make smart, sound decisions on this front, everyone has to be designated correctly. In which case, I would like to say immediately, before we even start with the guards, I am so annoyed by the fact that Ryan Howard is in the guard group. Ryan Howard, as a quick spoiler, I believe she has been one of the 10 best players in the league this year. We'll get into the case a little bit deeper shortly. But I believe Ryan Howard has just firmly been a top 10 player this year. Ryan Howard has also, as she has for most of her WNBA career, has just been the three in Atlanta. She should just be in the front court. And the fact that she is in the guard group with Alicia Gray, while Atlanta is also starting Jordan Canada, it does not make sense to me. This is a similar complaint that I had with Jackie Young, you know, so last year and the years prior, where they are starting Chelsea plus, you know, Kelsey Plum at the time, plus Jackie Young, where she has been the nominal three for most of her Aces career, and she's in the guard group. And I'm just like, why is she here? To the point where, earlier this year, Steve, I quite literally asked Jackie Young herself, hey, you've played a lot of positions. What position do you consider yourself as? And she considers herself a three. And she is once again in the guard group. Ryan Howard being in the guard group is insane to me because that's not where she is in the lineup. That's not generally where she guards. Though, you know, with key matchups, the Fever game, she'll guard Caitlin Clark. Like, she will mix in defending guards. But largely, she is defending wings and forwards. It's odd that we are here. And I think that does have it has an impact on trying to split through who the guard selections are and who the front court selections are. She shouldn't be here. And the other part that annoys me about this, it'd be one thing if it was like her and a bunch of other players in her ilk, and it's like 2-3 range, et cetera, that had this kind of problem. Gabby Williams is in the front court, as she should be, because she has largely been the three in Golden State, as she was the three in Seattle, et cetera. Bridget Carlton is the three. And this is with her being kind of the nominal two in Portland for most of the year, starting alongside Carla Leigh when they had Nadia Powell starting at the three, et cetera. So it's just like, you can do the three is in the front court thing. And like Ryan Howard, for some reason, is just in the guard. I don't like it. Not because she hasn't been very good, because she has been. But like this, that's not how that's supposed to work. And now it is Ryan being matched up with like Kelsey Plum and Paige Beckers and Olivia Miles and Caitlin and everyone. Like, it's just, she should just be firmly in the front court spot. Like, just number three behind, like, Asia and Stewie when we get there. It is, I don't get why. This shouldn't be this hard. This should not be this hard, Steve. I want to get this out of the way first so we can actually have the basketball conversation for the rest of it. It should not be this difficult, man.
It's so funny. Come on, man. So let's talk about real quick. Like, growth. Growth. We got to have some growth. You get so riled up about this every year, and they're never changing it. You saw Nick Saban. Quit asking. I'm not doing it. So what are you going to do about it? You have the worst possible scenario, and you got to grow around it. Now, what I will say, to your credit, it's an interesting dynamic in the sense that generally I feel like Ryan Howard gets slid to the guard group. Because the front court is usually just an abomination of strength with different players who just kind of dominate. And it's like, well, why put Ryan Howard through that? But this is a year where there are some question marks in the front court to a degree. And Ryan Howard probably could have slid in the front court this year. But that's this year. Because usually we're talking, it's Asia Wilson, it's Stewie, it's Aaliyah Boston, it's Satu, it's Nneka, it's Alyssa Thomas. Like, you can run off six or seven names. It's Nafisa Collier. Like, you can run off a few names in 30 seconds, and Ryan Howard's not there. Not that Ryan Howard isn't great, because she's amazing. But that's usually, okay, well, let's take Ryan Howard out of that. Slide her to the guards. We're going to talk about a lot of these debates, because they get real interesting. Because we got splits that are going to be pretty insane. It's going to be wild. Mm-hmm. What I would say is, like, I think it becomes fascinating, right? Actually, you know what? Can I ask you a question? How do you feel about positions, Nikias, in general?
I think ideally this is just a positionless exercise. And I understand that I am likely going to be in the minority with that opinion, and I am fine with that. But I think ideally we should probably just be in the positionless realm and just get the 10 best players in as the league continues to get not just better, but more versatile overall. And since they end up doing like drafts and stuff anyway, like you can still find your way to like five positions that make sense for both of these teams. So I think I would just generally go positionless for this. Oh, but then, you know, with what we're working with right now, like if, go ahead.
Well, if you're positionless, then why are you mad?
Because the voting is not. And thus, if this is the context that we have to work within, we need to be able to vote for the players where they actually play. I understand your point, and I wouldn't be surprised if the logic is actually what you said, in that, hey, let's move Ryan to the guard group because the front court group is kind of whatever. Which that would also just kind of be the question, like, okay, if you're doing that for Ryan, then you probably should do that for Gabby, and you should do that for insert players here to make it fair for everyone. But, like, I wouldn't be surprised if that was a part of the calculus. My thing is, even if you were correct, Steve, that is literally wrong because she is not a guard. Again, and this is, to be very clear, this is not me saying Ryan is not good. It's not saying Ryan does not initiate the offense at times. She has just been the three in Atlanta. Like, that's just what she's been. Jackie Young, she's been the three in Vegas. Gabby Williams, she was the three in Seattle. She's been largely the three in Golden State outside the last five games when they changed their starting lineups and listen, he's in. Her and Kayla Thornton are your forwards. They're starting Veronica Burton and Gabby Williams together. But, like, she has largely been the three. And so if this is what you are and where you played, if this is the format that we have, when it changed the position list, I don't have anything to say. I can just pick the best 10. But if this is the format that we have, Ryan should be in the front court. Gabby should be in the front court. Okay. Like, that's just how that...
Let's have some fun. That's all I'm saying. So when the Dream go with Jordan Canada, Ryan Howard, Borlase, Hillman, and Angel Reese, what position does Ryan Howard play?
Three.
Borlase is not a two. Come on. Don't you dare.
You think she's the three? Like, if we disagree, like, that's fine. Okay. That's fine. Like, yeah, I'll probably disagree. But.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, this is, it can get gray. That's my only point.
It can get gray. That's a good shot.
Do you have any other rants, bud?
No, that's just the major one for me. Because, like, that is just one. And even with that example, like, that is a sub lineup for the Atlanta Dream. Like, that is not primarily what she plays. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just, if this is the construct, I want it to be as tight as possible. That's my major point. You know what I mean? Like, this is basketball at the end of the day, so I'm not, like, actually losing sleep over it. But within the basketball context, yes, I am annoyed by this. Because, like, that's just not how that, it's not how it works. It's not the case.
Here's the thing, bud. You're going to keep yourself in a loop of frustration if you are mad about who's positioned where, and then you're mad about the voting. And I'm going to work to help you get out of this, brother. We're going to get there together.
We love a good throwback. We need that being spliced in right there. That's what we need. We're very well done. But okay, rant over. Again, I wanted to get that out of the way so we could just actually spend the rest of the time talking about these cases. Because to your earlier point, even with like injuries and things like that, we still have a very deep cast of characters. We start with the guards, which again, for the starters, you only get to choose four.
We're starting with the guards. Good God.
I mean, we're already here. Would you prefer to start with the front court?
No. This is a bit. Because look, in my notes, I have you only get to pick four to start in all caps. This put me through. I got anxiety yesterday doing this for a quick second. So I was just like, this is not easy. I'm not going to sing it. We'll do the pause meme. It's fine. We'll just hold. It's my fault. But it's it's difficult, right? And I think this is the dynamic that'll be fun to discuss with you, because there are a lot of cases for a lot of great guards in this league because they've put on some tremendous basketball. I think it gets interesting because, look, when we do these exercises, I have my opinions, I have my thoughts. I also have a bit of realism in my brain, right? And the voting's going to get funny, and you'll rant about that later. But for me, you pull up whatever spreadsheet you want. You can debate a wall. You can pull up efficiency, whatever metric. You can put, like, go to your store, get a Sharpie, write down Caitlin Clark's name. She's going to be there. And so that's where, for me, it got interesting, because I have to put her in as one of these starters because she's going to be there. And so I'm interested to see how you got to what you got to with the guard list. Because for me personally, and I've done this with the NBA, but like, there's no way that Caitlin Clark's not going to be a starter. So now one spot is gone. You say we only pick four. We can only pick three.
I see. I think that, I mean, this is fundamentally like where we differ when it comes to like the award conversations that we have, because you do bake in, I think this is actually how this is going to go. And so like, I don't disagree that Caitlin is probably just going to firmly be one of the four. And it's not like she doesn't have a case right now, to be very clear, about being one of the four. For me, I am very much, when we have these conversations, I am of the mind of like, okay, what would I do? Regardless of what it actually ends up being or not, even if I'm heading into a pick knowing that it's going to be a minority pick, I'm just generally like, okay, I've watched a lot. I'm asking questions. I'm looking at numbers. This is what I would do if I had a media ballot, type B. And so for me, I guess to kind of start things off, so Caitlin Clark is a lock for you to make, you know, to be an all-star starter. Did you have any more locks in the guard room?
If you want to personalize it, it's fine, but Caitlin Clark's going to be an all-star starter. It's going to happen. I'm so sorry. I think if you put Caitlin Clark in Sharpie, you can go ahead and get a quick pen and write Paige Becker's name down.
Okay.
I just think those two are going to be there.
Okay.
And so for me, and this is why we do this way. Like, cause you could say, this is what I think, but I like to give the people what might actually happen, because I think that's the fun of the exercise. If people are going to vote a certain way, okay, well, what's that look like if that's a finality, right? If Caitlin and Paige are going to be all-star starters, we now are talking about two spots to a degree. And that's where it gets nasty. Because who gets these next two spots? And the interesting part is this is not a Sabrina year. Sabrina has played a singular game. Sab, Oregon Duck legend, probably not an all-star this year. So who soaks up these two other spots? And the voting dynamic is going to get funny. 50% fan vote, 25 media, 25 player. So where does that land? And we've seen players who've had good seasons kind of falter in one or two of these three areas. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you my other two that I had written down, because I have a list. I did a Nikias thing. I was sitting there watching soccer tournament yesterday afternoon, and I was trying to figure out how to approach this. And I had Caitlin, I had Paige down, because I feel like they're going to be there.
Okay.
I went with Olivia Miles, because I feel like Olivia Miles has been extremely dynamic and could just capture all three portions to a high degree. That leaves it real interesting with the names left on the table: Alicia Gray, Ryan Howard, Jackie Young, Kelsey Mitchell, Kelsey Plum, Marina Mabry. A lot of names for what turned out to be a singular spot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the overall thing, as we talk through this, I got to a list of the names of people I think will be all-stars based on the numbers between starters and reserves. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how it shakes out between the starters and reserves.
Okay.
Right? So that, it gets tricky, because I started with Kelsey Plum, but I also had Jackie Young. I had Ryan. I had Kelsey Mitchell. I wouldn't be surprised if Kelsey gets four. I wouldn't be surprised if Ryan gets four. I wouldn't be surprised if Jackie Young gets four, but I went with Kelsey Plum. So those were the four I went with to start.
Okay, fair enough. I think for me, I had two locks heading into the exercise with the guards. Kelsey Plum was one, because I think she's just firmly been the best guard in basketball to start the season.
Mm-hmm.
25-7. 67% on twos, 41% from three on high volume, 80% from the line, also averaging a shade under two steals per game if you care about that portion. 1.3 points per possession on isolations this year while leading the W in ISOs. She has been insane. Nearly 1.3 points per possession on drives, which is the best among players that have logged at least 75 so far. Over 1.2 points per possession on dribble handoffs. The Sparks, who have been aggressively mid, largely because of the defense, they have won the Kelsey Plum minutes this year. And they have a positive net rating with Kelsey Plum on the floor. Nearly a -8 with her off the floor. And so, like, the impact is there on top of what she's doing with the box score numbers. Again, the drives have been insane. The playmaking has continued to perk up. She's shooting the leather off the ball. Like, I think she's just been the best guard in basketball this year. Kelsey Plum was a lock. The other lock that I had, very timely, as we're getting ready to talk a lot more about her over the coming pods, Olivia Miles was also a lock for me.
Okay.
18-5-6. 59-37-91 shooting splits, because she's been shooting the leather off the ball from deep the last two or three games. 1.4 steals, 0.8 blocks, run more pick and roll than anyone in the league so far this year, and they've been incredibly efficient when Minnesota's been incredibly efficient when she does so. As we talked about on, what, the last part of the pod before that, like, her numbers suggest she has been the best perimeter defender in basketball by a wide margin. I do not think that is true based on the film that we got, but she has done her job defensively on top of what she's doing offensively. Minnesota's over 20 points per 100 possessions better with Olivia Miles on the floor, which is insane. Also kind of speaks to how they keep their starters together with a lot of these lineups, so like that factors in. But she's been nuts. And as the graphic shows for the people watching on YouTube, she's been even more nuts during this win streak. So those were the two players I'm like, okay, y'all are in. And then we get into the others. I am also partial to the Paige Bueckers case this year. 20 points, 4 rebounds, 6 assists. The most difficult thing that I've been trying to parse through with Paige's season is like how I felt about the defense, because it's been a pretty mixed bag for her, in my opinion. But I'm also trying to weigh that with her defensive role and her defensive responsibility shifting quite a bit from what it was last year because of the lineups that the Wings have had to toss out this year. And in light of, like, you brought Alanna Smith in to help anchor this defense, and she just has not been good enough so far this year. And so, like, that adds to the extra layer of we kind of really need all y'all to do your jobs as we come into different lineups and things like that. And so, like, that's where she went from, like, she is in for me, but not, like, a firm lock, because I was thinking about some of these other contestants here. But Paige would also be one of the guards that I have. So that's three. And then beyond that, we circle back to the top of the segment, Steve. Ryan Howard ends up getting my last spot, but I am thoroughly annoyed that I have to give Ryan Howard this spot instead of giving her the front court spot that she is supposed to have. Because Ryan Howard, as of recording, 18.5 points, 3.5 rebounds, 3.5 assists, 3.2 steals per game for Ryan Howard as of recording. Not only is she leading the league in steals, Steve, if this pace holds, she will become the third player in W history, joining Teresa Weatherspoon and Tamika Catchings, as players to average 3 steals per game for an entire W season. She has been nuts defensively to start the year. Firmly all defense level. Honestly, should garner some like fringe DPOY consideration for what she's been able to do for what has been, I think, the second or third ranked defense in the league for the Atlanta Dream. In the offense, she has shot the leather off the ball. Drives feel better, but you still want a level of improvement there. The playmaking has been fun for me at the very least when they've allowed her to initiate. So like those would be my four as of recording. But ideally, Ryan would just be in the other group, which would open the door for a Caitlin Clark case, an Alicia Gray case, Courtney Williams, I think, having a very underrated season right now. But like that's where I land with like my four guards. I had two locks. My four, I think we end up with similar players. Paige's in, Ryan's in, Olivia Miles in, Kelsey Plum's in.
Understood. It's very interesting because the door you're saying to open the case, and that door's open. So Ryan Howard will be an all-star. Don't be wrong, but it's interesting to get there. Now, do we want to go to the front court and then kind of discuss who all could get there? Because again, I feel like I have the names. It's just balancing it out. Because again, like we're talking about starters right now, but the bench, it's going to be 3 guards, 5 front court players, 4 wild cards. I think most of the wild cards will be guards, in my opinion.
Kind of have to be with how they've.
So I think we're going to get 11 front court players. I think I have the confidence in the 11 names I have. I think you got enough guards, more than enough guards to get there. But it gets really interesting to see how it slips and like how it fits together. So do you want to go to the front court? Is that what you want to do? How do you want to get
there? Yeah, we can go to the front court. And then from there, I might spend a block on like some shout outs I want to give on the guard side. But let's get to the front court, because that is also worth some hand wringing. Even with, as you've been like, no Nafisa, you mentioned no Sabrina Ionescu, who would normally just garner a lot of votes and generally just plays well on top of that. But, you know, no Sabrina in the guard, no Nafisa Collier in the forward group, which opens a door. But oh boy, there are a lot of fun cases. So I guess to start, Steve, who would be your locks in the front?
I mean, front court got real interesting for me as far as who gets voted in, right? Easily, number one, Asia Wilson. That took not even a second. Click, vote, done, over, whatever. I had Stewie, number two. And I had Aaliyah Boston as my third lock. I feel like those three will be in. Now, once you get past those three, this is where the journey begins. And again, like absolutely, it's a lot about what do I like? What do you, who do you think has earned an all-star spot? There's a lot of that. But if we're being realistic, what's the splits going to look like? And I ended up jotting a lot of names down. I think a lot of them will end up being all-stars. But who ends up being a starter is fascinating to me. Because you're ending up, if those are my three locks, I got three spots for Angel Reese, Alyssa Thomas, Nneka Nwumike, Natasha Howard, Jessica Shepherd, Jonquel Jones, Gabby Williams, Kiki Irifin, De'Erica Hamby. Imagine if Rekia Jackson was healthy. Shout out to Rekia Jackson. Tremendous season. Mm-hmm. So for me, I ended up landing on Angel Reese.
Okay.
I ended up landing on Alyssa Thomas.
Okay.
And I ended up landing on Jessica Shepherd.
Okay.
But I would not be surprised if Nneka ends up getting voted in split-wise. Like, once she's had a good year, but split-wise, it could get interesting. Natasha Howard's had a great year. Like, Jonquel's had a great year. I don't know how it necessarily splits between them, but that's what I landed on. Nekias, where were you at with the front court?
Oh boy. Okay. So similar to the guard group, I had two locks heading in, and then others with strong consideration. We'll go through that. But the two locks for me, Asia Wilson, as you mentioned, like leading the league in scoring and blocks. She's been incredibly efficient. She's shooting over 50% from three, Steve, which that's just not how it's supposed to work in light of everything else she does. We had a deeper Aces conversation on Tuesday, so I'm not going to hang too long here on the Asia segment. She is an all-star starter. We do not have to take that. And Breanna Stewart has not been able to make threes again, but has done literally everything else again. 20 points, 9 boards, 3 assists, a steal and a half, and nearly a block. Leading the W in free throw attempts. Over 1.1 points per possession on post-ups. Like, the post-ups in particular, they have fried BC. Watching the different way, like, she may just dribble into one. There's just random transition seal stuff. There is, hey, let's toss the ball to the free throw line. She turns like, oh, cool. Well, I guess we're not getting into this handoff. I'll just put someone underneath the basket. She has been so dominant as a paint scorer again, and that's before getting into the actual drives for Breanna Stewart. I've really enjoyed her season. Like, those are my two locks. After that, because we got to get to six. So four more spots are available for, you know, all the names that you mentioned, plus Shakira Austin also deserves a shout for the year that she's had. And so it's like, ooh, how do I decipher who deserves all-star consideration and all-star starter consideration? So I had to, like, draw the line somewhere. And so the players that I considered elsewhere for all-star starter consideration, Alyssa Thomas, who has been one of the rare bright spots for a Phoenix Mercury team that has not won enough games, which is unfortunate for them and for, like, the extra boost in terms of, like, the all-star cases. But AT is still averaging 15, 7, and 8, second in the league in assists, nearly 2 steals per game. She's leading the W in points generated via assist, and so it's in the top 5 in overall points generated per game. She's up there. 10th in pick and roll defense. Like, the Mercury have been a much better team with her on the floor versus her off. Funny enough, the Mercury have won the minutes with Alyssa Thomas on the floor without Kalia Copper. So, like, that's been, we will keep an eye on that as that sample grows. But, like, AT's been insane. Natasha Howard very much deserves firm all-star consideration. 17-7, nearly 2 steals per game and a block. Seventh best pick and roll defender in the league among players that defend at least 100, under 0.8 points per possession on those. Converting 67% of her twos is one half of the best pick and roll duo in basketball this year, her and Olivia Miles. It's been insane watching her work. She deserves consideration. Jessica Shepherd, only player in the W with a triple-double so far this year, and she has two of them. 14-11-6 is kind of insane. Has taken on a lot more playmaking usage. I think she has helped accentuate the off-ball talents of Paige Bickers, AZ Fudd, etc. Unlocks the cutting for them. Like, the one drawback, and she ultimately ended up being in for me anyway, but the one drawback is, like, the defense for Jessica Shepherd, it is an adventure at times. And that is where, like, you would want Atlanta to have a better season to safeguard against that. It's why the pairing with her and Awat Kuir has been so successful for Dallas so far this year, because there's just a ranginess that kind of helps Jessica Shepherd in some of this. And so, like, when they've been on the floor together, they have a 97.7 defensive rating, which is insane. But, like, Jessica Shepherd deserves consideration. Angel Reese going to deserve consideration. League's best rebounder on both ends of the floor. Atlanta's been a much better team on the floor.
So who did you pick?
Well, I wanted to lay out some cases. Okay. Well, the four that I ended up with, Steve, Alyssa Thomas, Natasha Howard, Jessica Shepherd. I went with Angel Reese. And I was very close to going with Jonquil Jones over Angel for this last spot. But I went with those four. Jonquil is right there. I think she's going to be an all-star. The only thing with the Aaliyah Boston case that I've kind of struggled with so far is largely been the minutes for her. And she by far is like below just about everyone in terms of just how often she's played. So like if you get into some hair splitting there, looking at some of the on-off stuff for all of the bigs, as I did for everyone else, as I was building the cases for everyone else, they're pretty much neutral with her on the floor. But a lot of that is tied to what the minutes with her and Caitlin on the floor together have been like. Her without Caitlin's a plus 12.4 right now, which is wild to me. Kelsey Mitchell also has some pretty wild on-off splits as we circle back to the guards at some point. But like that was the only thing that was kind of keeping me from Aaliyah right now as a firm starter. But she's been very good when she's been on the floor. And so Jonquil, Aaliyah, NECA, probably my first three out right now. Go ahead.
Uh-huh. Run those four for me again that you picked on top of Asia and Stewie.
So we got Asia, we got Stewie, we got Alyssa Thomas, we have Natasha Howard, we have Jessica Shepherd, we have Angel Reese.
So you have come on this podcast and not had a single fever voted in as a starter.
That wouldn't be where I would have it as of June 12th.
All right. Continue on.
Which, again, I'm fine with being yelled at on that front. And I think, again, Aaliyah Boston is right there. Jonquil Jones is right there. The Angel one was an interesting one for me because as I was heading into this one, I thought she was going to be like one of my first ones or first, you know, one or two out because like the scoring efficiency had just kind of been what it is. But then you get into some of the underlying stuff with her. Well, again, the on-off and her impact to the defense has been pretty wild. Defensive rating goes from 99.7 with her on to 107.7 with her off. While the finishing hasn't been where you want it to be, she has offset that by having the highest free throw rate of her career, and she's knocking those down at a 78% clip. What shocked me, Steve, which also makes sense in light of the foul drawing that she's provided, in isolation, 1.1 points per possession on trips featuring an Angel ISO, largely because of the foul drawing and some of the playmaking that she's displaying when she sees the next defender. On post-ups, 42, one of the highest marks in the league, over a point per possession on those as well. And she's outpacing some legitimate stars in terms of what her team is generating on her post-ups compared to some of the other ones. So I'm just like, okay, the finishing slash shooting is what it is. And if anyone has her out because of that, like I think that's fair in light of what these other cases are. Again, like Jonquil and Aaliyah Boston are out for me right now. So you could very easily put one of those two in for Angel and I wouldn't be upset about it. But the defense has been at an all defense level this year. The rebounding and in general, her impact on extra possessions remains top of class. And offensively, she is still finding ways to generate efficient offense despite not being the most efficient scorer in her own right. And so when you have that plus the impact stuff, that's how it ultimately landed with her in. And she's, again, shouldering a pretty big minutes load on top of all of this. So that's how I land there. Do you want to circle back to the fever guards real quick? Or did you want to add something to the front court portion?
No, I mean, I think I'll be very intrigued to see who gets voted in the front court and how that like balances out. Because again, remember, like it's a split. So we saw Angel get a high fan vote and did not get much of the median player vote. So I'm intrigued to see if someone's able to slide in because of that at the end of the day. But I think I feel pretty comfortable with who I think are all-stars overall, if we're talking about 10, 11 players. I think Natasha Howard and Jessica Shepherd will be there. I think Jonquil will be there. I think Gabby Williams will be there. It'll just be interesting to see who kind of ends up slotting in as a starter and then what the fallout is from there. Like, and so it's like Alyssa Thomas has been the engine once again. It hasn't been the loudest statistical year to a degree as far as the triple doubles go, and the Mercury are not winning. I don't think it's going to take AT out of the all-star race, but it is interesting. And like for NECA has just been solid. But the Sparks haven't necessarily had the type of success, but that's never stopped NECA from being an all-star. So it's interesting to see kind of how things get balanced out. I think that will be fun because again, there's no fee. Satu is working back to being Satu off of the injury. So it's like there's not as many automatics this year. So I'm interested to see how it kind of works out.
No, I think that part's fair. And again, we got two more weeks before the voting ends on this side. And so we will see like how these different seasons kind of shape shift. Like someone goes on a run, like to the guard portion. Like I didn't have Jackie Young in, largely because of what the start for the season for her was offensively. What she's been doing during this win streak for the Aces has been absurd. And if she keeps up this level of play, would not surprise me if by the time we get to June 27th, if Jackie is just one of the guards. You know what I mean? Like, that can shift for me. To the fever portion very quickly. Oh, go ahead.
Well, as I said, before you get to the fever portion, I think, like, no matter how the voting shakes out, I think Jackie Young, Ryan Howard, Kelsey Mitchell, they will be all-stars.
They're going to be.
Like, I would probably, based on what I said out here out loud, I'd probably just slide them into the three guard spots as far as the coaches will select. Like, they will be there. Now, after that, Nikias, I know you're about to talk about the fever guards, but it gets hard.
No, like this is, again, a very, very, very deep class. And I do not begrudge, like, because obviously, like, there's, as you mentioned, there's the 25% media vote. Like, for those who have to fill out those ballots, I do not envy having to parse through some of these cases. Especially in light of, again, like Ryan's in the guard groups that the front court group. Like, that's whatever. But anyway, I do not envy that portion. Now, to the fever guard group. One, I agree with you that, like, even if we broaden this conversation out to just who's making the all-star team, I think Caitlin and Kelsey Mitchell are going to make the all-star team. So, like, I want to say that outright. And to the Caitlin case, as of recording, 20 points, 5 rebounds, 8 assists per game. She is second in points generated via assist, only to Alyssa Thomas right now. Over 38 points per game generated overall. We talk about the scoring plus the assist. That's second to Kelsey Plum, who, again, firmly stating that she has been, I think, the best guard in the basketball this year. I think the only thing that kind of drew me, that kind of hindered me from the Caitlin as firm starter group versus Caitlin just being an all-star for me, it's largely been the defense. And, like, part of that is her. Part of that is what Indiana's trying to do structurally. Part of that is what opposing offenses have done in light of what the Fever are trying to do structurally. But it is still over 1.1 points per possession on trips featuring a drive defended by Caitlin. Same thing in isolations. And this is with her. She's tied with Pauline Astier for defending the most drives in the league this year. She has doubled the rest of the league in terms of isolations defended so far this year. And the Fever are winning her minutes, but they have performed as a better basketball team with her off the floor so far this year because the defense improves more than the offense dips when she sits, which kind of flows right back into like some of the Kelsey Mitchell on-off things that I alluded to earlier, to where she has wilder splits than I anticipated based on the year she had. Obviously, the bucket getting has been very important for her, averaging over 20 points per game. But like that's, I think like playmaking slash defense is where I'm like Kelsey's an all-star, but maybe not a starter. And then largely the defense for Caitlin is where I'm like, she is an all-star, but not a starter for me. And so, like, that's kind of my big thing on that front. But both have been good enough offensively to where they warrant a consideration. And if we're getting into, you know, all-star predictions versus building your own ballot, yes, Caitlin is absolutely just going to be an all-star starter. And I'm not going to be super upset about it. Ooh, but, like, that was kind of where I was.
But that's kind of yourself. Where I was. Save yourself a reaction video. Let's go. Shout out to Nikias Duncan.
But in all seriousness, like the defense, there's some on-off stuff. There's some underlying like player tracking data stuff that goes in. That's where I went from. Caitlin's an all-star. I don't know if I would have her as a starter right now. So that's it. I'm sure I will get the I hate her and all that good stuff. But those were my earnest
bets. I just tried to save you from trying to land the plane that way and you still did it. Listen to me, God.
You know what? Fair enough. Can I ask you a couple of guard questions before we move away from that? How seriously did you consider? Because we talked about Jackie Young. How seriously did you consider Chelsea Gray, who has probably been like their most consistent guard this year, if not their best guard so far this season?
Chelsea's on my list for the guard play. I just think there's a lot of guards, and so this could be a year where, from an all-star perspective, Chelsea's impact gets muted. It shouldn't, in my opinion, but like, there's a lot of good cases. Like, in theory, right? you are having to pick potentially between one of two Tempo and one of two Dream. Mm-hmm. And then if you add one of two Aces on top of that, it can get tricky. Mm-hmm. Like the math gets hard for Chelsea. Less than Chelsea has not played at a high level because Chelsea Gray's been a metronome for the Aces this year on both ends of the floor. Mm-hmm. No doubt about that.
No, like he's flirting with a career high in assists, which is kind of wild this late in her career. After last night's record tying performance of 9 made threes against the Portland Fire, now officially shooting 42% for three on over five attempts. Career high in volume for her. And the defense is... Oh, go ahead.
I do want to know, what does Chelsea Gray have against the Pacific Northwest? I gotta ask at some point, like, what you did that to Seattle? you took Seabird and said, "Get out of here." Then you make that many threes in Portland. I mean, what happened?
and those threes weren't hitting anything either. I was like, "Oh, this is this is different." But yeah, you have 3-point shot making. Obviously, you get to the tough mid range shot making, converting 50% over two so far this year, and the defense. Hey, man. You think you can post up Chelsea Gray because she is guard size, and then you pivot and you turn around and you try to go up with your shot, and suddenly the ball is going off of your knee because she stripped it away. You're like, you're just not having a fun time on that front. So I don't know if I can get to like the fringe all defense case that I ended up with last year. Ultimately didn't make it on my fake ballot, but like was in consideration. I don't know if I'm quite there yet this year, but she has still firmly been a positive on that end. So I think if the Aces get two, I'm probably inclined to say the two should probably be Asia and Chelsea, based on what we've seen so far this year. Now, again, Jackie Young has rounded well into form at this point. And so if that continues, it may just be Jackie and Asia again if they get two. But right now, I'd probably say it's Chelsea and Asia if I had to say they get two as of June 12th.
Wow.
Brittany Sykes versus Marina Mabry was interesting. It's, well, she's just been very good.
You took away the question I was going to ask. Which Toronto Tiff will get... has a stronger all-star case, Brittany Sykes or Marina Mabry? This guy, he looks at his notes, he just starts letting it fly. He's the Stephon Marbury of MDA notes. What are we doing?
Oh dear, I'm so sorry. My answer is probably Brittany Sykes, because I felt better about the defense. Least perimeter players and free throw attempts. Like it's really weird balancing like the scoring efficiency for her. 60% at the rim, but like she is shooting poorly from just about everywhere else, but she's getting to the line a ton, so she's still been efficient overall. And then the defense just kind of is what it is. Like around the fringes of the all defense conversation, the event creation remains very strong. Marina Mabry, I do think, has like legitimate case here as far as just making the all-star team. Like I can't get to starter, but scoring well, she's been one of the best pick and roll creators in basketball so far this year. And a lot of that has been growth in playmaking, growth as an interior scorer, pull up scorer. It also helps that she isn't getting blitzed as much as she was in Connecticut. So, like, she actually just gets to make more comfortable reads. So, but I probably lean Brittany Sykes right now. Would you go Sykes or Mabry? I'll toss it back to you.
Marina Mabry.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong. Sykes has been great and incredible and important, but I think Marina's different times for this team. Can Veronica Burton climb the ladder this year? Does the world understand how good Veronica Burton is and how important Veronica Burton is for the Valkyries? And like, I think Veronica Burton will be an all-star. But do you think Veronica Burton will become an all-star starter? Is a question I would throw your way.
All-star starter, probably not. Because I do think, just generally speaking, like everyone knows, like Caitlin plus Paige plus Kelsey's plus everyone, like she doesn't have like the mainstream fanfare, I don't believe. So like that hurts when it comes to the fan vote. And so to your general question, I don't think the broader audience understands how good she is and how impactful she is on both ends of the floor. Now, to the actual ding to her case for me in terms of all-star starter, I do just kind of need the finishing to be better. And like, this was part of the Valkyries conversation we had on the previous pod, where like they are shooting the leather off the ball as a team from three, but they have also been one of the worst finishing teams in the league to start the season. Like, part of that is Veronica Burton not finishing at the level that I thought she would in light of the rim pressure that she provides. I think if she finishes more slash gets to the line more, and like, that has already perked up from last year, then I think the scoring goes up, the efficiency goes up, and like her case just feels louder on top of the impact stuff. And so I think if we get better finishing over the next 2 weeks, it wouldn't surprise me if Veronica Burton kind of rises in the ranks here, because she has just been incredibly good for Golden State. But I'd keep an eye on the finisher.
Okay, very good. I think I have room for one more question, maybe two to a degree. Sonia Citron, how do we absorb her all-star case this year?
The Mystics as a whole are interesting to me because I've watched them. It's like I like the growth that I'm seeing from Kiki, from Shakira, from Sonia. And I think Sonia taking on more on-ball responsibility and her getting, frankly, just getting jumped as often as she is with the ball in her hands, like, this is not the natural role for her. And I think she is taking that in stride within what has been a wonky roster context and is ultimately just a rebuilding squad. She's someone that I think is going to garner some fringe consideration from the coaches and things. But, like, I don't know if she gets in. I think it's kind of where I'm at.
Okay. Before you go, my last one probably is, has Olivia Miles' success, one, made Courtney Williams better, but also made people forget how good Courtney Williams is?
I'm glad you went there because that's where I want to go to close things out. Nobody's happier about being shifted to the two than Courtney Williams. Career high 17 points per game, 52% on twos, while draining 52% of her mid-range shots, Steve, per W stat page. 8.9 mid-range attempts per game, which is by far the highest mark in the W. Draining 52% of them is insane, which kind of quietly masks the fact that career high in three-point volume, only at 3.5, that's dipped over the last couple of games. She was taking over four games. But shooting 41% from three, which is a quiet but very important development for her. Six boards, four assists, still in the half. Like, yeah, I think the Olivia Miles piece has kind of overshadowed what Courtney Williams is doing. I think in light of, I guess, like, the impact of Olivia Miles. Like, it's kind of, it's a double-edged sword to an extent. I think Courtney is having this level of scoring comfort in part because Olivia Miles has taken over the primary playmaking duties. But also, the scoring efficiency from Courtney Williams with this shot diet is kind of nuts and deserves more credit and attention for what she's doing. So, like, yeah, I think it is, quote-unquote, Olivia's fault. Yeah.
Very good. I lied. I have two more questions. The sky falling, has that just hurt the Skylar Diggins all-star case to a degree that we can't bring back?
The sky falling and also Skylar not playing at the level that she started the season at. Like, it also hasn't been, like, the greatest finishing slash mid-range scoring season for her either. She's at 40% on twos, which is almost a career low, but is the lowest that she's had since her Tulsa days. And so, like, that plus the defense has been fine, not great. And as you mentioned, like, the sky being in this tailspin, like, I don't think she's going to get the fanfare. So I think that's kind of where I'm at with her all-star case, at least as of today. We'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks.
All right, my final thing before we get out of here, I am so sorry to our team, but it's time for the Mourinho Hottest all-star case.
Pauline's been better. All right. Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel. That's where the W content is living. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel. That is where our finals coverage is going. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20, where he will probably be sending a not nice tweet about what I said to cap off this podcast. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.